Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 101, recorded February 21st, 2012.
Oh, look at all those syllables you had to use to say 101.
I know.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
You know, it would be really cool when we get to our 111st. I guess we've talked about that already, huh?
Yeah.
That's okay. Today, we will be hearing from Dan in Washington and Tony in New York, Juliet in Paris, Alex in Melbourne, and Drake in Oregon, and Anne in Pittsburgh.
If we get that far.
If we get that far. If we don't get through everything, we'll get it next week.
Yeah, we'll see how we go. Mm-hmm.
So, shall we start?
Indeed.
Okay. Dan in Washington says he went out today to a drainage ditch to try to get a Daphnia culture, and when he got home, he discovered that little creatures moving around looked like they were cyclopoid copepods and not Daphnia at all. He says, I'm assuming that ones that look more like tiny tadpoles are the males, no egg sacs behind. I've been reading that these things can carry parasites and kill, or even kill fry, yet I know they are used for fish food, so I'm confused. If these things actually multiply so that there are a lot of them, would any possible parasites be long dead, since the copepod life cycle is so short? I was hoping to raise my own live food, but I'm thinking this might not be the way to do it. And to be honest, these little critters somewhat creep me out for some reason.
Well, that's a good point. There you have several good points that you raise.
The fact that they're creepy?
The fact that they're creepy. Well, I was thinking more along the lines that they could be possible vectors for parasites. And because you can introduce parasites to your aquarium just by going and catching something. It does happen.
I wonder if there's some correlation between creepiness and parasite vector-ish.
It could be. I don't know. But he was talking about how they are used for fish food, and ones that are commercially used for fish food, at least one of the brands with which I'm familiar, Cyclopes, use species of copepods that come from highly alkaline saline lakes.
So there aren't a whole lot of parasites living in them because it's too salty?
At least not anything that can be transmissible to fish because
they don't want to be in freshwater.
Habitat-wise.
Okay,
right.
I see.
Something like brine shrimp from the Great Salt Lake or from San Francisco Bay area don't generally give parasites to freshwater fish because it's just not.
The parasites are not going to live in the freshwater.
Yeah, anything that could live in one of those environments couldn't live in the other.
Okay.
So, I've also read about this idea that copepods can kill fry, and that they can harbor parasites and or pathogens. Although I have heard that they usually only do the former, that is, killing fry if they're in large numbers. But I've raised celestial pearl danio fry in planted tanks where there were lots of copepods, and the danios feasted on the nelpli, or the very small young copepods, and did fine. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't have had parasites or anything like that. That's definitely a possibility. It's an interesting sort of problem because someone has to go catch something wild that could have the possibility of introducing parasites and then start culturing it. You know, that's where we got
start somewhere.
All kinds of creatures that we're culturing, but it's kind of tricky. It's difficult to say what parasites they may or may not have or how we could interrupt the life cycle of the parasites by culturing them in isolation. That generally tends to help because if they have intermediary hosts or intermediate hosts, then it's not likely to work. The parasites can't continue if they have obligate intermediate hosts. But, you know, I'm not sure which parasites they might have, so it's hard to say. But one good point maybe we could bring up is that reef keepers intentionally introduce all kinds of species of copepods into their aquaria by means of live rock and live sand, and it works really well for them. And most of my tanks have a modest population of copepods that came in on plants or whatever.
And the fish just snack on them.
And the fish just smack on them, the small fish at least. But I do think that high yields for modest effort in terms of live food, copepods are probably not the best choice. Daphnia or Moina or something like that, for example, would be... You get higher yields for less effort. So then Dan emailed back or sent a message back and said he's going to try to get Daphnia. So that actually
sounds
leads
like
us on
to
our next contributor for the day.
From
so
Tony.
Thank you, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Tony, New York. So what does Tony have for us?
Well, he had been asking about raising Moina in his triops tank last week.
That's right.
About that. And He, after we did that, he responded, we had talked about the fact that, in my experience, and in some, according to some sources that I've read, culturing cladocerans like Daphnia is difficult to do in planted tanks. But he found a link of someone who had been doing that.
Culturing them in planted tanks.
Yeah, with floating plants, like water lettuce or something like that. And so he included his link. I read it. I can't remember exactly the plants, but I followed the link that he sent, which we'll put on the page. You can take a look at that. And he said that in addition to the interesting things that he found in the article, one of them was that Daphnia loved to swim to the light, which is very true. It's a good way to collect them, much like young brine shrimp, when I first hatched, we'll do that, and then that helps you collect them.
You just
them.
Shine a flashlight on the top of the water and scoop them up,
you
or
can,
what?
Well, with brine shrimp, typically you shine it at the side, and then you go to that area where the side is, and you siphon them out. And with my Daphnia, I think I've showed you, where I'll hold the flashlight to one side, and I'll swim over to that side, and that makes it easy to just net out a big ball of Daphnia. Anyway, he said he guessed that Daphnia may have trouble in planted tanks because the plants compete with algae, which is a great food source for them, but that's only a guess, he says, and he's going to try the Java moss with Moina and see how it goes.
Good luck.
So, to follow up on that, a couple of things. He said that he's going to be doing a few extra cultures in separate jars, which is always a great idea with Daphnia and Moina and so on. So he's going to give that a go. I have found a link by someone who has been culturing Daphnia with some interesting food sources. So I included this link. They use some things like alfalfa hay, just letting it decompose in the water. Apparently the infusoria population in the water was a good food for the Daphnia. So there are some other things that he used too in this link. So check the link out. It's for people who breed amphibians, aquatic amphibians, actually.
Oh.
But still Daphnia, it still works. So check out that link.
What amphibians do they use the Daphnia for?
Well, specifically tailed amphibians like newts and salamanders.
Are the Daphnia big enough for them to even be interested?
Oh, larval okay. ones. So it works pretty well. And I'm really excited about what I read there, using the alfalfa hay and some other items. So just check that out. I'm going to try this out as soon as it gets warm enough, I think, outside. So, he also wanted to mention, Tony did, that the skeptical aquarist discussed aquarium-safe rocks in depth right after we talked about some aquarium-safe options for Tony.
Oh, lovely. So all kinds of good information then.
Yeah. Who knows? Tony thinks maybe someone there did it because of what we were talking about. I don't know if the skeptical aquarist folks listen to us or not.
Skeptical aquarist, do you listen to us?
I don't know. That's kind of cool. All right. And, everybody's got to check out what Carlos put on.
What did
this
Carlos
isn't exactly, he didn't have a question exactly, but he put on Facebook, there's this meme going on the internet where they
okay,
have a
set tell me
set
what a
of,
meme is, I'm not
kind
a
of like an
person.
Idea that you do stuff with, you do variations on it.
Okay.
And there, it's kind of like a picture, a series of six pictures, and it says what I think I do, what my mom thinks I do, what my wife thinks I do, what society thinks I do,
great.
This kind of stuff. And Carlos shared one up on the Facebook page about aquarius. It was saltwater aquarius, but he said it applied to freshwater.
Oh,
so check that out on Facebook. It's very funny. So so thank you for sharing that, Carlos.
Hang it next to your tanks.
Yeah, it's cool. And then Juliet.
Juliet, we haven't heard from Juliet in a while.
From Paris, France.
Yes.
She sends her congratulations for our 100th show.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And she also has kind of an update. She says her cribs have spawned.
Ooh.
Which is cool. Cribensis, the cichlid from West Africa. She's wondering about how the pH might influence them. Her pH is pretty high at about 8.3.
And what do they like, usually?
Well, this is the interesting thing about cribs. That's fairly high for cribs, but our pH here is a little lower than that, quite a bit lower, but it's still higher than their ideal of neutral, 7.0.
Oh, okay.
That's their ideal. The interesting thing about that is if you get a pH that is significantly different from 7.0, it skews the sex ratio of the fry.
Really?
Yeah.
Like some species are influenced by temperature. they're influenced by pH.
Yes, and they may or may not be influenced by other factors as well, but that factor does seem to be pretty important.
Which direction does it skew it towards?
You know, off the top of my head, I can't remember which gender is related to which pH value, but at 8.3, you're likely to get a whole lot of one gender.
Not very many of the other.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. So that's one thing you'll probably be discovering soon, because she followed up. Not only did they spawn, they also hatched.
Oh, cool.
So let's hope they
should take some pictures and send us some baby pictures.
Yeah. She did say her quarry spawn often, and she was just trying to save some from a coolie loach the other day. And she scraped them off, and which you can do with quarry eggs. Mm-hmm. They're pretty tough if you're careful. And put them in a net breeder or something like that in the side of her tank, but they went fuzzy.
Oh,
they started to develop, but they went fuzzy, and that sometimes happens. And she's still having a problem with her shrimp splitting shells.
But she's
got some good news, though.
What's that?
She found two really great websites that go in depth with shrimp. So those of you shrimpers out there, this can be really nice.
Did she send us links?
She did.
So those will be on the page.
We'll put them on the page. But caridea.org is one of them.
You want to spell that?
That's caridea.org. That refers to the group of shrimp in general. And that, unfortunately, right now is only in French, which is great for our French listeners, but could be a little difficult for
some of the rest of us. Would Google translate it, or would it just be
butchered? Well, you know, you can put things through Translator, and
sometimes when you go to a page, it says, translate this page,
right.
Yes or no?
Sometimes you can glean decent information that way, and sometimes it makes an entire shambles of it. So you can always try it,
though.
Yeah. You can always try it. Sometimes if you're familiar with the context that it's being... what it's coming from, that often helps, and you can get some idea, but it does mess up some things. But Juliet is actually thinking about translating it for them into English, which would be really nice.
Perfect.
And then she also has another website that seems to be connected in some way with it, or have at least a lot of the same information. And this one is in English and German.
Okay.
And this one is crustahunter.com.
You so, spell that one too.
crustahunter.com.
Like crustacean hunter.
Yeah, like crustacean hunter. So
not like bread crust.
No, not like that. So that could be really helpful for our shrimpy folks out there to check out. Because she's really not sure what's going on with her situation, but it's not doing all that well. She did mention that those websites indicate that it could be a water condition problem that's not too uncommon. Okay. So hopefully that will be helpful. And if anybody else has any other ideas about what's going on with the shrimp, please let us know. She was also wondering about African dwarf frogs. She's thinking about getting some. And they do okay at a high pH. Tolerably well at a high pH. They might not breed at a high pH, but they should be okay as far as living. They come from alkaline water themselves somewhat. Their preferred range is in the high 7s. So her water is considerably higher in pH, but
they might still be okay.
They'd probably still be okay, even if they wouldn't spawn. I'm not sure whether or not they would. But
I gotta love the dwarf frogs.
Yeah, we've got three of them. They're
fun. Just very cute.
Yeah, she's also wondering about KH.
She's
been taking some readings of her water. She said her nitrates and ammonia are excellent, but that her KH is 10, and KH is carbonate hardness. And there are two kinds of hardness. There's KH and there's GH, general hardness.
Okay.
And they're different in that general hardness is sort of counting the calcium and magnesium ions in the water. KH is counting the carbonates in the water. In other words, it's counting the buffering capacity of the water, the amount of acid that could be neutralized by these carbonates that are in the water.
Okay.
And hers is a reading of 10, which should be fine for shrimp. That's not bad.
Is that... what's the scale to?
The scale? Well...
yeah, like, is that high on the scale? Is that low on the scale? I don't know what the scale is.
It's moderate on the scale. It's...
okay.
Yeah, it's not bad. Okay. And I guess it depends on what you mean by on the scale, but, you know, I've read some sources that say that KH...
they step on the scale, and the scale gives them a reading.
Okay. Well, I've seen KH be anything for shrimp recommended anything from 5 to 15. So
okay.
That would be mid-range
so
for that particular scale. Yeah. Oh, look, it's time for our break.
Our lovely break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nell.
All right. Well, thank you, Juliet, for sharing those links. And hopefully that gives you a little bit more information on dwarf frogs and about your cribs and so on that could be helpful. So let's go to our next contributor.
Oh, Alex from Melbourne.
Yeah. Alex from Australia. And he said that he agrees with our assessment that the plants have been taking care of the ammonia. He's almost certain that that's the case.
Back up and remind us what Alex's situation was.
Well, he was trying to cycle a tank. Uh-huh. And he was trying to cycle a tank at about 6.1 or 6.2 pH. Mm-hmm. So where the ammonia is in the form of ammonium, which is much less toxic to fish than ammonia is. And as he was trying to cycle it, he was noticing at first he was getting some ammonia readings going down and nitrites going up and so on, as you would expect with cycling. But then the ammonia shot up and then it shot back down, but there were no nitrites or nitrates appearing.
So he's wondering where it went. If it went down, what did it turn into?
Right. And he's wondering what was going on and why his tank didn't seem to be cycling, why he was adding bacterial additives that didn't seem to be helping. And I mentioned two things. One's that he's got a lot of plants that are doing well, so they are probably...
They're just taking the ammonia and using it straight.
They're using it, because they'll use it without it being processed to nitrites or nitrates. Okay. They'll just use it as ammonium, preferentially some plants even, before they'll rather do that than use nitrate. It's metabolically less costly or something like that. So he's got that going on. And then he's also got the fact that the pH is so low, not dangerously low for tetras, which is what he's got in there, but... the kind of tetra he's got in there, it's not dangerously low, it's in a good range, but this is the situation. The nitrifying bacteria at such low pHs, around 6.1 or so, don't really do a whole lot.
They don't really turn it into nitrate.
Right, so all of his readings, ammonia, nitrite, and nitrate, are all sitting at zero, so the plants are probably just taking care of it.
Okay.
So as long as he can keep his plants happy, he'll probably have his fish happy, because he don't have to worry about those toxins in the water. And he said the low pH is a result of a small piece of bog wood. And he says that he'll try to make it smaller, given that his tank is only 12 gallons, and he didn't realize the effect the pH would have on bacteria. Well, there's something I'd like to say about that.
You go ahead and say it.
Okay. The bog wood, you could take, a piece off the bog wood and so on. The thing is, that bog wood is going to lower pH for a while, because it's releasing tannins.
Leaching stuff.
Yeah, its tannins are leaching out of it into the water.
Did he leach it before he put it in the tank? Did he soak it previously?
I don't have information on that, actually. But I would assume that either he didn't or he didn't do it for long enough that all the tannins were gone. Because he's saying that it is affecting the pH. And what it does when it releases those tannins, the tannins are acids, tannic acids, and they are making the water, they're acidifying the water. But what's going to happen eventually, just through regular water changes, the tannins in the bogwood at some point are going to be exhausted, and then your pH is going to go up. And so that may not be a problem, but you're just going to have to watch for that, because it could have some effect on things, especially depending on how fast it goes. Hopefully it'll be gradual, and it probably will be fairly gradual, and that's okay if you're making the change gradually, because you don't want to make it fast on the fish. But once it starts going up, as long as the plants are fine and they're absorbing all the ammonium and or ammonia before it gets to be a problem, that's great. But if there are any problems with the plants, then suddenly you're going to have
a problem.
Toxic ammonia situation, very likely, because
it
bacteria
hasn't actually cycled.
Right, the bacteria haven't cycled. So just keep in mind that you're going to have to monitor things to watch that. Now, speaking of monitoring things...
So, before we move on,
go
I
ahead.
Have a question.
Go ahead.
Just kind of on the subject of cycling in general.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better then, or worse, or does it not matter to cycle with live plants? Because if they're preventing the actual cycling from taking place, mm-hmm. how does that work?
Well, basically, the important thing is you want to have high water quality for your fish, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your plants are removing the nitrogenous wastes
mm-hmm.
before they are a problem, then you're keeping your water quality high for the fish.
But if something happens to your plants, then you're in trouble. So would it work to cycle it without the plants and get the bacteria going and then put plants in? Or would that just eventually cancel out the bacteria because the plants are just grabbing stuff?
See, that's a great question. I think that a lot of tanks, if they don't have a lot of high growth plants that are doing really, really well, you know, mm-hmm. they have a moderate amount of plants in the tank. You have some bacteria that are doing part of the job, and then you have plants that are doing part of the job. If you have just a couple of plants in a big tank with a lot of bioload,
bacteria
are doing a lot
of
the work.
More of it.
Right. But if you have a lot of really healthy plants and in a tank, they can take care of it. And then you don't really need to worry about it as long as you're keeping the plants healthy. The fish
okay.
will be happy too.
So it works either way as long as it doesn't break down.
Yes.
It works as long as it doesn't break.
Exactly. And if it ain't
right.
broke, don't fix it.
And if it is broken, then you have a problem.
Yes. So, anyway, speaking of water quality and so on, Alex, to help manage his water readings and aquarium-related expenses, he wrote a web-based program
mm-hmm.
to help him do that. And he's shown it to friends and so on, and they've had some really positive feedback for him. So
is
he's decided to make
like
it free.
Kind of like an accounting program, but just an aquarium planner?
Yeah, yeah. It helps you specifically keep track of your water readings, such as pH, ammonia, nitrate, and so on.
Well, that's cool, because then you could go back and, you know, look over time and see if there are patterns or anything that you need to figure out. Or
right, right. And he wants to make it free for everyone to use. So he's
Hooray.
Got a link for us, and we're going to put that link on the page.
It's a slightly late Valentine's Day present for everybody.
Yeah, so... Yeah, thanks, Alex, for making that available to everyone. And we'll put it right there so everyone can click on it. But I'll give you the URL is aquarium-manager.hero.com. And I'll put it on the page, too. But there you go.
That's pretty cool.
It also works on mobile devices.
Are we going to use it? We should try it out.
Yeah, I have played with it, actually.
Oh, good.
I put some of our things in
it
already.
Put it on the iPad?
Yeah.
Sweet.
So it's cool. We'll check it out. And one point that Alex made is that you can take your mobile device to your LFS, your local fish store, and you can have all this information about your tanks.
About That's really useful.
What's been going on in them and so on. And you've got to log in to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to have a connection.
Internet access.
Yeah.
But
that's cool. So, yeah, thank you for making that available to everyone. I'm sure that'll be useful for lots and lots of aquarists.
Very cool. Okay, we're going to go to Andreka in Oregon. Let's read Andreka's email. She says, "So, I was at my local PetSmart, where I first learned about primary and secondary foods. While this chart does not have a brand name associated, the food in the freezer is by Hikari. When I asked at PetSmart or look for more information about these, none is to be had." So, Andreka would like to know if you have any thoughts about what you have to feed your average fish tank and how much variation in that food source you would recommend.
Okay.
She says, right now we have shrimp and bloodworms. Every once in a while I feed betamins. Once every other day I feed algae wafers, which everyone loves. I tried cooked veggies. I only left them in for a few minutes, worried it would pollute the water. The guy at PetSmart recommended leaving it overnight. What do you think? Ultimately, though, how often should I rotate out a selection of food? Is it okay to feed just bloodworms and shrimp, or should I do more? How essential is live food for the average freshwater tanker?
Okay. Well, those are a lot of great questions here. Let's see. I would say, honestly, most adult, easily kept aquarium fish are fine with just a high-quality staple diet, as long as it's high quality. So if you get a really good brand of fish food that includes, not a lot of fillers, but things like fish meal and squid meal and so on in its first ingredients, and not a whole lot of grain fillers and things like that, that a lot of them can thrive on a diet like that without anything else for quite a while. And then there are, on the other end of the spectrum, there are some more finicky species that won't take dry foods. They just won't. And some of them won't even take frozen. I've kept some fish like that. So you do have a few of those. But as far as the easily kept average freshwater tank kind of denizens that you'd find in a community tank that most people would keep, they can do fine. I think it's more important to make sure the food is fresh. So buy enough food that you'll use it up in a few months, maybe within 4 months or so.
So smaller package, not necessarily, even if it's cheaper in bulk, maybe get a smaller package anyways. Just make sure you're going to use it up.
Make sure you're going to use it. Make sure to keep the lids on tightly and so on so it stays fresh. After maybe 6 months to a year, a lot of the vitamins and so on aren't going to be in the food anymore. It's just not stable enough. So there's that. But supplementation is good for fish. Variety is good, I think, for fish too, even though they can survive and be pretty healthy on just, you know, one kind of food as long as it's fresh and so on. Supplementation is good. It's interesting for the fish, I think, and it's interesting for us to watch the fish be interested
in
different fish. But I also think it's good for them, health-wise. I think that if you were to use a good high-quality staple diet and supplement it with shrimp and bloodworms, that's good for a lot of community fish. If the fish tend to have more vegetarian taste, though, I think the veggies would be beneficial as well. And it depends on the kind of veggies. We have bristlenoses all over the place. We don't even count our bristlenoses.
We couldn't count the bristlenoses.
Bristlenose placos. But in some tanks, we just have one or two, and then in other tanks, we have... Like in this one right here, I don't know how many
they breed in there, and we just, oh, look, there's more.
they never stop. So in those tanks with bristlenoses, we'll drop a vegetable in there and leave it there till it's gone, because it's gone pretty soon.
Because there's enough of them that they eat it.
Right. But I would say if you're doing something like frozen peas that are shelled, or a green bean that's been split in half or something like that, that's not likely to do a whole lot with pollution, and you have fish that are eating it actively, you just can just drop it in and leave it there, and it'll be gone before
you... It doesn't seem like something really green like that would pollute it any more than an algae wafer.
Even less, actually. But
is it kind of maybe the vegetables have high sugar content that are...
Yes, that's a good point. The only vegetable I've had a problem with dropping in and leaving, really, is sweet potato. Slices of sweet potato. I have to keep those pretty small and thin.
Do you put them in cooked or raw?
Raw. Okay. Yeah, because they do have a high sugar content, and you can get some bacteria that can cause a little bit of cloudiness as they're using up all that sugar if you put in too big of a piece. But
how long do you leave it in for? If it's not gone after a day, do you take it out?
Yeah, but that's about the only one. The other ones, the fish finish off so fast. But I would say if your fish aren't finishing it off because you may have a different composition of fish in your tank, then 24 hours is probably good. If you notice it, you know, disintegrating or anything, getting spread all over the place but not really eaten, that's probably a problem. But the big staples that I use, which are the thawed frozen peas with the shell removed, zucchini, split,
when you say
split
shell,
split
you mean
beans.
The skin around the individual little pea. It doesn't mean like snap peas that you take off the shell.
No, although I do add snap peas once in a while too. But
zucchini
slices, cucumber slices too. Yeah, you have to be careful with the seeds of those because they'll float and get stuck in your filter. But you know,
you can poke those out.
Yeah, you can poke them out. Anyway, those are some things you can try, and just don't put in very much. See if it gets finished. If it gets finished quickly, great. If not, then you can take out the rest in 24 hours. I think.
Ooh! Can we use a movie quote on what you just said, friend Draka? Because she's the one who asked. If he falls, fine. If not, the sword.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So, I would say you're probably fine using what you use already with the shrimp and the bloodworms and the algae wafers and occasionally cooked veggies.
Sounds like you're a good fishy chef.
Yeah, exactly. I would say when you're talking about breeding, it's different. I mean, there are species that really need live food to get into breeding condition, and then the fry often do better on live food, and some just can't survive without it. In an article I was reading in Aquarium Fish Magazine, I think it's the April edition, or the April issue, talking about some new studies that say that fry can eat some foods that are not live, and sometimes they will eat them, but they will starve, and apparently the reason why they starve is because they need the live food to introduce certain types of gut flora to help them digest what they eat.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Once they've got that, they can live on other things, but they need that life food initially to get the gut flora established.
Probiotics.
Kind of like, yeah, kind of like rabbits and some other animals that do similar things. So, that was very interesting. She would also like us to bite the bullet and do our top 10 list.
Because we still haven't done that.
Yeah, we can, you know, this is the thing. There are way too many, but we'll just give you a list of some of them.
That we use frequently.
Yeah, these are ones that we use quotes from a lot.
In no particular order.
Yeah, and doesn't even mean they're necessarily our favorites. All-time favorites, some of them are, but just means...
It means they have useful quotes.
Right, so let's go quickly through
The that. Princess Bride.
Star Wars Trilogy.
Lord of the Rings.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Chronicles of Narnia.
Harry Potter.
Emperor's New Groove.
1776.
Support Your Local Sheriff.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
The Russians Are Coming.
Willow.
And You Can't Take It With You, which is the version... shown on TV, I don't even know how many years ago, with Jason Robards on it, which I don't know if is actually available other than on the ancient cassette that my parents taped it off of TV from. Yeah. So,
and that's like 13, not 10, but there you go. We did it.
So there's your homework, Andreika. You can go watch and read all of those, and all will become clear.
Okay, thanks, Andreika.
Okay, we're going to go to Anne in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
She says, well, I was hoping to write in for the 100th episode to tell you that we had GBR, Fry. Tell me what GBR is.
German Blue Rams.
Oh, okay.
We cichlids from South America.
See, I'm not up on all my...
You like them.
...initials. I like them.
Yeah.
Okay, he knows what I like.
When you see them, you say, those are cool, I like those.
But unfortunately, the night I was going to write in, they disappeared. Hopefully it will work out for them soon.
Well, since you've seen Fry, you have a great chance of getting some successful ones. I mean, one thing about...
Once, it'll happen again, right?
Yeah, most likely. And cichlids go through a parenthood learning curve. Can't blame them there. So did we. So are we.
Yeah, fortunately we didn't kill our children, though.
No, that is very fortunate. that's very fortunate indeed. And we're still learning a lot, and cichlids do that too. I mean, fish are learning. And that they'll probably do better in the future. An interesting thing that she was saying later on is that they spawned on this leaf that's slanted.
Uh-huh.
And so the little wrigglers, when they've barely hatched and they're just sitting there attached to their big egg sac, and they're just wiggling around, they're not really swimming.
Mm-hmm.
She said that...
Did they wiggle right off the slanted leaf?
The father was kept on putting them on it, and then they'd just slip right off. And then he would deposit them back on. It was really fun to watch.
Well, that's a great illustration of parenthood right there.
Yeah, either that or it's like...
shoveling against the tide.
Shoveling against the tide, yeah. It's kind of... I hope you have a video of that. But it apparently didn't work for them too well. And so Anne tried to make them kind of a better cave with a flat rock.
Mm-hmm.
The area they had chosen was more of a cave in the sense that it had plant cover around it, and so she's removed some of that plant cover so they don't spawn there, hoping they're spawning in the rocky area that sounds like it'd be a better place for them. But, yeah, hopefully that'll work out soon.
Good luck.
Anne also did say that the slightly higher temperature and half-dose salt treatment for dealing with ick that she was dealing with earlier seems to have worked. She doesn't see any more fish losses or any more spots.
Good.
And it's been a while now.
Yay!
It's been some time. So that seems to have worked.
Evil ick is vanquished.
So now she's going to try to decrease the salt back down with water changes.
To normal.
Yeah, and an interesting thing about how ick works, fish will develop an immunity
to iodine powder. That was for Andreika again.
From Princess Bride.
Yes.
For ick. What could happen is that your fish in the tank now, because they were exposed to low doses, so to speak, of ick, and it was treated, and so they didn't get the full brunt of the attack, so to speak.
I was just going
to
say brunt.
There you go. They may have developed enough immunity so that they'll be okay, but when you introduce new fish in, sometimes there may be a few little parasites at low quantity in the water now that are attacking the fish but not really getting anywhere.
It's almost like they've been immunized.
Yeah. Kind of. Something like that.
Kind of like chicken pox.
Right. And then when you introduce other fish in, they might start showing up with it. Possibly. Okay. Because they'll be immunosuppressed a little bit from the whole stress of moving from one tank to another, or from a store to a tank, and so on.
But you never know. Salt and the temperature increase again.
Right. And you could do that. Another thing that's interesting, though, is that there are apparently more... a number of strains, two or three strains of ick out there, and so they may have immunity to one and not to the other.
Oh, super bacteria ick. That's scary.
Well, it's not actually a bacteria, but yeah, well, it's super parasite.
You know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll see how that goes, but there's an idea for you that just to be aware of that. And, she also says congrats on the 100th episode.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, several of you have said that, so thank you.
We're excited
about it. And we have something cool coming up that relates to that, but we'll let you know about that later. Anne has another question, and it is a great question, about moving one tank and switching it out for another one. But we're going to come back to that later, because this one is going to take a while to discuss in depth and do it justice.
So we will visit that next week.
Yeah, so for now, we just like to say thank you to...
Dan.
Tony.
Juliet.
Alex.
And Draka.
And Anne.
And may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.